California's tax plan. Senator Mondale, however, claims that you have an outrageous record on tax reform, and that both you and President Ford have supported a long list of tax loopholes. How do you respond to that?
Well, I didn't really expect an endorsement from Senator Mondale. He has an outrageous record, too.
You both served in the same committee, sir, about tax reform.
That's right.
Do you feel that you have a really defensible record on tax reform with tax loopholes such as tax shelters, foreign tax deferrals, and so forth?
Well, let's see now. As the investment tax credit loophole, Governor Carter took $41,000 off his income tax last year. I'd like to ask Senator Mondale if that's one of the loopholes he has reference to. I favor the investment tax credit. Obviously, Governor Carter does.
Senator, have you given the president any advice on how he should behave in the debate tonight?
No, I really haven't. I don't think he needs it. I know he's been preparing very hard for it. I'm going to watch very carefully to see if I can pick up some pointers for our debate in mid-October.
Senator, are you still convinced that it's that important?
I think it's very important, particularly this first one. As I've said, it's sort of like the first moonshot. A lot of people are going to tune in because they really want to watch it. Others are going to be curious. It's a very good and exciting spirited debate. It may change a lot of minds in America.
Do you think a lot of people have not made up their minds?
I think a lot of people have not made up their minds. Plus, I think there are a great number out here who are uncommitted and a number who might change their minds. I think it's very, very fluid.
Do you Senator, think the presidential election could depend on the debates?
What's your opinion of a Playboy interview with Governor Carter?
I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. In Nebraska
that?
Or in California.
What about that? Do you think that the debates could determine the election?
Well, I don't know. I'll watch it, and I might be able to comment on that after the debate, but it's pretty hard to make a judgment before they've had it.
Senator, is it likely that either man who might be perceived as the loser of these debates could win in November?
I don't know. I go back to the Nixon-Kennedy debates, and I remember I was campaigning my first time for Congress, and Nixon was the obvious loser in the first debate. I never thought he ever really recovered from it. I think the same thing could happen. Everybody's predicting it's going to be a standoff, but who knows? We're all going to watch, and I haven't made a judgment yet. I hope President Ford does a good job. I would advise Governor Carter to reread his platform. He calls for 65 new or increased spending programs and 22 new or expanded or increased agencies. So he may, maybe he didn't read the platform yet. I'm all for streamlining the bureaucracy, and I hope we can do it. My voting record reflects that, and we'll try to work on it next year. Thank you. This morning we had breakfast on a farm in near Hastings, Nebraska, and then went to Trumbull, Nebraska, population 50, and that's then to San Diego is quite a jump, but we've been jumping around the country, and I understand that I'm at Rotary, and being a Kiwanian, I want to thank you very much. And I understand that you don't allow partisan remarks, and so I'll just tell the truth, and you can draw your own conclusions. I spent some time in San Diego in 71 and 72. You know, we were talking about having our convention here at that time, and I really considered it a pleasure to be back. I didn't think I'd be coming back in this role. In fact, as we travel around the country almost on a daily basis, more and more people are asking how I got on the ticket. It increases each day, and so I thought I might explain that before someone here jumps up in the middle of my speech and asks me. On the 19th of August, in the morning news, there was a report that President Ford had narrowed the selection to four. And the one who would be chosen would be with the president at noon, and there would be a joint press conference. Well, the first name was Ann Armstrong. I knew she was in London and couldn't possibly get back by noon, so I scratched her off the list. The next was Bill Ruckel's house. He was a fine Republican from Indiana. He was up in Tacoma, Washington. And besides, his name is a little large for a button, so I figured it probably wouldn't be Ruckel's house. And that left Senator Baker and Senator Dole, so I told my wife, Elizabeth, if he doesn't go in alphabetical order, I've got a chance. And so we sort of waited on that basis, and wasn't very long after that, we heard a lot of commotion in the hallway. And we were right next to the suite occupied by Governor Connally, so I assumed that it was probably going to be Connally, and the press was gathering for the big moment as he rushed out of the hotel to secretly go over to the hotel where President Ford was. But in any event, our curiosity got the best of us, so I told Elizabeth, I said, go to the door and put your ear there and see what they're saying out in the hallway. It's legal in Kansas City if you listen from the inside out. It's And sure enough, somebody mentioned my name. We didn't know who it was, but we thought, well, I better get dressed in any event. And so when the president called about an hour later, because of the proximity of my room to Governor Connally's, and thinking he might have gotten the wrong number, I accepted before I identified myself. So I... And from there on, we sort of hit the ground running. And it's been suggested the president just couldn't make up his mind, and he flipped a coin, and it didn't come down. He thought I was an obvious choice. So, but we've been working at it. I'm very proud to be running with President Ford, and of course, as just been reported in the news, tonight is the big night. Tonight may tell it, well, I don't think tell it all, but it may tell a great deal about who wins on November 2nd. And we're very pleased to be in San Diego. We're going to have a chance to listen very carefully and watch the debate and then proceed to a meeting to discuss the debate and hopefully announce that our man won. And I haven't any preconceived judgments. We're going to try to be objective. But we are leaning in one direction right now. I think I can discuss a little bit about leadership at the Rotary Club without stepping on any toes and maybe tell you how I view it and how I think other Americans may view it. You know, this is the first of three debates, and it's been an accommodation worked out for Governor Carter so that he can give all of his positions on each issue. And if you don't like the answer tonight, you can tune in next week and get another answer on the same issue. But I think it's nice of President Ford to agree to that because people want to know where we stand, even when we're moving a lot. But I really believe when it's all said and done that the major issue in this campaign is going to be the kind of leadership America needs and the kind of leadership either President Ford or Governor Carter project and the kind they offer America. And if we go back to the time of the founding fathers and they learned the hard way about the dangers of too much power held by a single individual such as a king or even by a group of individuals such as a Congress, they knew that even the noblest men are endowed with human frailties. If men were virtuous, James Madison warned the Constitutional Convention, there would be no need of governments at all. So they put their faith in our system of what we commonly refer to as checks and balances. And in distributing power among the three branches of government, they pitted the frailties and excesses of one branch against those of the other. Ambition was made to counteract ambition. Factions were set against factions, so as to prevent anyone from becoming a tyrannous majority. The collision of these forces was conceived as a wellspring of sensible and moderate government. And the founding fathers intentionally provided both the president and Congress with coordinate powers to create laws and to make treaties, to appoint officers of government. What does this tell us about the kind of president we want? I think it means we must look for a person who has the strength of conviction to act as a counterforce when necessary, a balance against potential irresponsibility of an unchecked congressional majority, and a check against a conventional wisdom which often proves wrong tomorrow. And in this context, I suggest that anyone who objects to the use of the presidential veto, as Mr. Carter has and Mr. Carter does, simply doesn't understand our system of government. Now, well, I think, and as I said, I have some prejudice and some bias, I think President Ford fits the mold envisioned by our founding fathers. I'm not arguing that this or his particular views, sound as they are in most cases, necessarily justify his election or re-election if you consider his selection by the Congress as being an election. Instead, I am saying that at least he represents something, a consistent view of his office, of the role of the government in the lives of our people, of the relationship between the federal government and the several states. And I suggest that Mr. Carter, on the other hand, represents nothing more than the Congress itself, a collection of conflicting and inconsistent views. The only difference is that in Mr. Carter's case, these conflicts and inconsistencies are embodied in a single person. And I find in him no basic political philosophy other than a policy of expediency aimed at satisfying whichever group he's addressing at the moment. And the contradictions and confusion which result from these are responsible for the popular impression that Mr. Carter is fuzzy on the issues. And the fact is, his stands are fuzzy because they are based on expediency and ambition rather than experience and philosophy. Now, I think these shortcomings disqualify Mr. Carter as a check on the excesses of a rather wide and wild Democrat majority in Congress. His own statement suggests that he would serve as no more than a rubber stamp for the Congress. They suggest he is a follower, not a leader. He has said more than once that even if he is personally opposed to legislation, he will follow the dictates of the liberal Democratic congressional leaders. And if we need further conception or evidence of his conception of the presidency, we need only to look at the reasoning which led him to attack President Ford's use of the veto. He admitted time after time he hadn't read the legislation vetoed by President Ford, but he condemned the president for knuckling under to the Congress. And by the same reasoning, one might condemn the Senate for not agreeing with the House and the Supreme Court for not agreeing with anyone. But during the past few days, much has been said about Mr. Carter's tax plans. He's told interviewers, and he's had a number of very splendid interviews the past few days, some we haven't had a chance to look over. But he said in an Associated Press interview, and I think members of this club and others who might have an interest in tax reform would like me to touch on that. And it's not my word or the word of President Ford or any partisan, not Leon Palmer or someone else who might be for President Ford. I think we can put Leon down as firm. But he said, in effect, that anybody above the median income could expect higher taxes. Now, we checked and learned that the median income was $14,000 for a family, a working husband and a working wife, or whatever. The median income for an American family is about $14,000 per year. And I think this says a great deal about Mr. Carter. We have seen that he rejects leadership. We have seen that he deliberately and admittedly shades or fuzzes his positions to make them more palatable to diverse audiences. But in the debate over taxes, we see that he is capable of proposing a reform without thinking about its consequences. And I think it says something about a person's judgment. And some who say that, well, maybe it's a slip of the tongue, we see that he's also exaggerated his record as governor of Georgia. And you may have seen one of his TV commercials on his tenure as governor of Georgia. He made the following assertions: that he streamlined and cut the cost of government in Georgia, The fact is that the budget of Georgia increased during his term by over 50%. He says he cut the size of the bureaucracy. The fact is that the number of state workers rose almost 20%, or more than 20%. He said he left Georgia with a surplus. Maybe peanuts, but not money. The fact is that in 1975, his successor had to call the Georgia legislature back for the first budget-cutting special session in modern times in order to balance the state's budget. And he points with pride to the state's Department of Human Resources, which he created as the showcase of his administration. But his successor, Governor Busby, says, and I quote, "When I took office," and Governor Busby is a Democrat, "when I took office, the Department of Human Resources was an organizational nightmare." Now, I think that this should provide some perspective on Mr. Carter's record as governor. Mr. Carter is fond of asking people to trust him, but trust is something you don't ask for, it's something you earn. You earn it by leveling with the people and by telling the truth, even if it hurts. And I guess it could hurt. It's too early to tell. But President Ford, in his legislative proposals, his executive initiatives, and his vetoes, has exercised the kind of courageous leadership our system needs, and it has worked well under his leadership. I don't think I need to repeat to this group, he entered the presidency at a very critical time, and it was said by a commentator about 2 weeks ago, I guess, or 3 weeks ago now, about President Ford, that whether he wins or loses in November, he will leave the office the same man he came in, the same decent, honest, open, candid president, the same Jerry Ford, if you please, in 1976 as we had in 1974. And that in itself says a great deal about the measure of a man, that success and power and all the things that go with the presidency, the most important office in the world, has not changed President Ford one bit. And he is still that same open, honest, decent, dedicated American. And I would only suggest, in this rather crucial day in the campaign, not in any sense that I'm in California, but because of the debates, you know, we have a right, I think, and certainly have an obligation to discuss the issues, to point up where we think the opposition has made mistakes, and they have the same right, and they've been exercising that right. Senator Mondale even went so far as to suggest about 10 days ago that somehow President Ford was responsible for the increased number of suicides in America. And I hadn't noticed any increase until the Democrat convention in New York. But there are rhetorical excesses in politics. There are statements made. We've been suggesting that pineapple juice is a lot better for you than peanut butter. For one thing, it doesn't stick to the roof of your mouth. But as we've traveled around the country, we've learned, and we've traveled at some length. I was chairman of the Republican Party during the Watergate period, and I would hastily point out that the night in question was my night off. As I recall, I was on a job in Chicago. And I remember those days very well. I used to try to get to see President Nixon occasionally, and I used to talk to Mr. Haldeman a lot. Then after a while, he gave me to somebody named Kerli, and pretty soon anyone who answered, I would talk to a lot. But one day, Haldeman called back, and he said, "I understand you want to see the president." I said, "Yes, I certainly do." I thought he ought to meet me. I was the party chairman, and we were going into the campaign. And he said, "Well, turn in Channel 9 at 7 o'clock. And that's more or less the response we had in those days. And I only point that up to say what a contrast it is with President Ford, who's concerned about openness, concerned about being candid, concerned about America. And I've said to my Democrat friends and my Republican friends and my independent friends, let's just take a look at the record. Take a look at what Governor Carter says and take a look at what President Ford has done. And that's how we make a distinction. It just seems to me that the record is there for all to see. I went to Seattle, my first appearance after being on the ticket to address the American Legion Convention. And Mr. Carter had just gone out, and he said to the Legionnaires, that not for their consumption, but for somebody up in New York or somewhere, that he believed in a general pardon, but he was against general amnesty. Well, I looked up in the dictionary, and it said under amnesty, general pardon. They were synonymous. And so I followed him the next day on that platform, and I said, and I repeat, the Ford Dole administration will not be for general amnesty or general pardon or general clemency, blanket pardon, blanket amnesty, or blanket clemency, because it occurs to me, with some hundreds of men still missing in Southeast Asia, some may be alive, some may be prisoners of war, that our first priority as an administration and as a nation must be to those men, those forgotten Americans in Southeast Asia, and not to those who forgot America in a time of need. And I think that's what it's all about. And to those who suggest that Mr. Carter is a conservative, and I say this to my Democrat friends as well who may have an interest, the New York Liberal Party is not known to endorse conservatives. They're not known to endorse moderates. You've got to be a litmus paper liberal to get the New York Liberal Party endorsement, and they gave that to Carter about 2 weeks ago up in an airplane. I guess they thought no one would see him up there, but it was reported. And he signed a little paper, and he was very pleased to have the endorsement. And then and that, of course, was preceded by bringing my good friend Walter Mondale on the ticket with him. Someone said, how can I tell you apart from Walter Mondale? I said, he'll always be with George Meany. And someone asked Meany why he didn't want to be president. He said, why step down? I think he's in the catbird seat now. He didn't have to run to their office. They run to his office on a fairly regular basis to get the drill, the next order. And I think it's all right for George Meany to have influence. He controls the Congress now, but I don't think he ought to control both the Congress and the White House. And I think we have an obligation as Americans and as businessmen and, yes, rank-and-file union members to check excesses of power. That's what it was all about, as I mentioned early on in my prepared remarks. We've got to check the excesses. And I don't believe it was ever intended that any one group, whether it be big business or big labor or big agriculture or whatever, should ever have a strangle on America. Now, I have to confess that I've never been honored with the endorsement of labor. I had the Women's Christian Temperance Union support, and that's about the only union that supported me, and they're doing a recheck, so I don't know what will happen there. We look at Governor Carter's record on defense. When he was running in 1972, he said we shouldn't cut the defense budget. In 1975, he said we ought to cut it $15 billion. Now he's saying we ought to cut it $5 to $7 billion. Well, I don't know where he's going to cut it. He hasn't suggested that. He just says we ought to cut it. That makes the liberals happy in parts of the country, so we ought to cut the defense budget. Well, as you know, if you read the news or watched the news yesterday, the president signed the defense appropriations bill, and for the first time in about 6 or 8 years, we have real growth in the defense budget. And I don't advocate waste or anything else in defense or agriculture or education or housing. But for the last 8 years, the liberals in the Congress have cut 30-some billion dollars in our defense budget. And for the first time, again, because in through the leadership of President Ford, we restored about $11.4 billion. And now Mr. Carter advocates cutting another $5 to $7 billion at the very time that Secretary Rumsfeld says that we may have to add $18 billion just to keep even. Now, I've got another sort of a gut feeling that I don't want to be number two in the world. I want to be number one for the sake of peace, not for the sake of war. And I have a feeling we can't deal from weakness. So I would just suggest that it's a very important election. I would hope that the members of the Rotary Club will be exercising their rights as free Americans to vote and encourage others to vote either way you wish. I'd hate to think that in this bicentennial year that less than half the Americans voted, and that's some of the predictions and some of the forecasts by some of the experts. It just seems to me that there's too much at stake, and maybe these debates tonight, if they're going to be a viewing audience or a listening audience of 100 million Americans, that may bring on more registration. That may bring on more participation. I just happen to believe that the great majority of Americans, and I've been in the Congress 16 years and done a lot of traveling in this country for the Republican Party, really have a moderate to conservative philosophy. And why is it we're dominated by the extreme liberals in the Congress and those on the other side? And I just want to get some of my conservative Democrat friends on the right side and our independent friends on the right side, because I think it's important. Oh, it's important for President Ford and his running mate, I guess, to be in the office, but that really isn't the important thing. The important thing is which direction do we go in America? And I think that's key to the whole election. And who's perceived as a leader? Who's had the experience? You know, some say, well, President Ford really isn't smart enough to be president. Like, I really can't understand that. He graduated with honors from Michigan. He was in the top third of his class in Yale Law School. He had 20-some years experience in the Congress. He was the ranking Republican on the Defense Preparedness Subcommittee on Appropriations. He's been vice president. He's been president for 2 years. And I guess when you want your laundromat or your washer fixed or your iron fixed or your car fixed, you try to find someone with experience. And he's had it. He's had it dealing in foreign policy and domestic policy with the Congress, with the governors, with the state legislators, with Democrats. You know, if you could take a secret poll among Democrat members of Congress who had a moderate philosophy and other Democrats across this country who held office and understood what experience meant, I'd be willing to predict that President Ford would win very handily among that group. And so I just want to leave the thought that leadership is what it's all about. Leadership for this country. And I believe, having known President Ford for 16 years, having served in the House with President Ford for 8 years, and having worked with him since he's gone on to greater things in the Congress and, of course, as president, that he gives us that dimension, he gives us that opportunity, but we're going to have to work at it. Because, again, the forces of organized labor, the labor leaders in this country are working. They're registering voters. They're registering their voters. They're raising money, and they're doing what they can. And I say power to them up to a point. I wish some businessmen would take a leaf out of their book, because we've seen the results in the Congress. We've seen what organized labor can do in the Congress. But they're doing too much. They've gone too far. And let's don't give them the White House. Let's make some gains in the Congress, and let's keep the White House in the hands of the American people. And thank you very much.